This is The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Faye Carruthers and welcome to The Guardian Women's Football Weekly. Women's Football Weekend didn't disappoint with showpiece events around the UK. Manchester is blue with City beating United at the Etihad, but Chelsea stayed top on goal difference after a win over West Ham. Arsenal's week went from bad to worse with another delay, this time after their bus was stuck in traffic, but they kept in arm's reach of the top two with a win over Aston Villa. Their third goal, though, needed some comedic music behind it as controversial refereeing decisions marred some of the weekend's action. We'll discuss all that, look at the latest in the Championship and the National League, plus we'll take your questions. And that's today's Guardian Women's Football Weekly. Women's Football Weekly is supported by Google Pixel, the only phone engineered by Google, an official mobile phone of Arsenal Football Club, Liverpool Football Club and the England teams. Google Pixel's working with the FA, Arsenal FC and Liverpool FC to close the visibility gap between men's and women's football with the formation of Pixel FC, a collective of next-generation creators and presenters dedicated to covering the women's game. They'll have exclusive access to players, additional resources and content creation opportunities to give women's football the visibility it deserves. Search Google Store to find out more. Do, 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 do. What a panel we have today, starting with the award-winning Susie Rack.
Let's not do that every week.
I would love to do that every week. For anybody who hasn't seen all over socials, Susie won the Women's Sport Journalist Award at the SJAs, which is the Sports Journalist Awards last night, the prestigious awards in our industry, and a well-deserved gold for Susie. Congratulations. We were still having a good old chinwag and drink in the early hours, Susie, weren't we? So slightly later recording today.
Yeah, just a bit. Be prepared for a slow start to the podcast this morning.
I know, I'm trying to channel all of my energy from 4 hours sleep. Not quite sure I'm fully making it. Marva, it's been a while. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. I know it's been a long time, it feels like. But yeah, maybe feeling a bit more fresh than you two today.
Yes, you are lifting us today, as is producer Sophie, who's still one of our guests, we are delighted to say, and is back on the pod after a few weeks of writing behind the scenes. How are you doing, Soph?
I am very good. I've had 2 days at home, which I've never had in like the last 4 weeks or something. So I'm very excited.
Oh, brilliant. Lovely. I'd quite like that. A couple of days' time when the international break is over and I might get my life back would be really lovely. Let's get started, shall we? After weeks of build-up, the Barclays WSL's Women's Football Weekend kicked off in style. 40,000 packing into the Etihad Stadium to watch the latest edition of the Manchester Derby, a fixture that's continued to grow in prestige and drama over the seasons. The stakes were high when these two met in the league back in November, and you'll recall the pictures of Chloe Kelly celebrating wildly in front of the Manchester United fans at Old Trafford as City earned a comfortable victory. Revenge was on the cards, but ultimately not possible. It seems as if little has altered in the trajectory of these two sides since then. Gareth Taylor's team once again beating their noisy neighbours. It finished Manchester City 3, Manchester United 1. It was all thanks to a first half brace from Jess Park, who was brilliant, and record-breaking strike as well from Bunny Shaw. Susie, that was Manchester City's 11th successive win in the league, which is quite incredible, one that sent them temporarily top of the table. Gareth Taylor remaining convinced that the title race is going to go down to the final day. What did you make of their performance? Does it make them favourites?
Technically, yes. Like, if you look at the run of games that Chelsea have got versus City, the number of competitions Chelsea are in, like, everything points towards Chelsea's like having a slip up somewhere and City winning the league. But I would just never, ever, ever, ever bet against Chelsea in the final third of the season. Like, I just think that's an insane thing to do. They are so viciously efficient when they get to the business end of the season. They've done it before, they know how to do it. So even though, like, you know, your kind of head tells you that City have a real shot here, I still don't genuinely think they do, because Chelsea just do not take their foot off the gas in the final third of the season. So, I mean, great performance and, you know, really solid victory against a stagnating Man United side. But yeah, I'm not quite sure that they are going to win the title just yet. We know my predictions are terrible, though, so,
They are, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. I'm normally right on you on that one, and they are terrible. So Manchester City fans, do not worry. Jess Park, do not worry. Standout performer, once again cementing her place at the heart of City's midfield. And of course, she is a lifelong City fan, so I was hoping that Susie's wrong. Put away two at the Etihad in front of the watching Serena Wiegmann. They were her first league goals for the club as well, which is brilliant. And Marva, I tell you what, she's been so crucial for them since the new year. What have you made of her development since her time at Everton?
Yeah, so good. I mean, she was very, very good at Everton, which is, you know, why I was so upset when she left. And you can see what's happened to our team since she's left. But what's really impressed me is just her development and her maturity now, and the other things she's adding to her game. The fact that she's able to muscle Zellum off the ball for that third goal, maybe that says more about Zellum than it does about Park. But I think that just shows, you know, maybe the kind of questions around her was, can she play that sort of centre midfield role? Can she, you know, she is obviously quite small, so can she bring that physicality to her game, which I think she showed there. But I think she also just showed real maturity in her decision making, like so clinical, obviously really like an incredible finish for that first goal. Second goal, big questions about the defence. I don't know how she was able to just wander into that box without Blundell realising, but even so, you've got to take your chances, and she did. And then for me, I think the most impressive thing was that third goal and how she set it up for Bunny Shaw to just immediately get the ball and just completely know where her players are. But I do also think that says a lot about City, and almost polar opposites to Man United in that way, where I think every time City get the ball, they know what they want to do. And you can see that. Like when Hemp has the ball, she always has an overlap. When Park has the ball, she always has an overlap. There's always Bunny Shaw running in behind. Whereas United, when they have the ball, it's kind of just like individuals playing. Whereas I think this system has really allowed Park to flourish.
And somebody else that's flourished is Bunny Shaw. You mentioned her there. 17th goal of the season, that one was. It was early in the second half. A strike that actually made her City's all-time leading goal scorer. 68 goals in 82 appearances is some return. Sophie, you described her as unparalleled in your match report. Is she the best goal scorer in the league, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I think she was really unlucky last year, wasn't she, when she was going for the golden boot race, the top goal scorer race in the WSL, because she was just pipped by Rachel Daly, who was having a ridiculous season herself, and somehow everything that she touched was turning to gold. But she's completely in a league of her own this year, I think, Bunny Shaw. She's added so much to her game as well in the last two seasons with City. The way that she comes to link the play, she's not just someone who just sits up front and waits for the ball to come to her. She's involved all over the pitch, and she drops deep when she has to. She links the play. She becomes a provider for the other goal scorers and other attackers in that team as well. And then when she does get on the ball and she has a finish like she has, and I mean, she just drove through the Manchester United defence there like they weren't even there on Saturday. They were trying to trip her up and everything. And she was like, no, I'm still going. I'm going through and nothing's going to stop me. She was determined to break that record on the Etihad stage. And she's absolutely phenomenal numbers once again. And she will only continue. You know, it's scary that she's got so many years ahead of her as well.
Yeah, it is really scary. She's some talent, isn't she? Let's discuss Manchester United, though, Marva. Fifth in the table, 9 points off Arsenal in third, 15 points off the top two. Just how serious is this drop-off for them this campaign?
Yeah, it's worrying. I mean, I don't think many people had expected them to be challenging for the title this season. I think we all kind of saw the dip coming, but I don't think any of us predicted the dip to be this big. I think they finished on about 56 points last season and they're on like 28. And with not many games left, like that's such a huge drop off. And of course they lost two big players, but it's getting to this point of the season now where when the drop-off is that big, you can't just blame it on those two players anymore. You know, if the problems were just Russo and Bache, which I know contributed a lot to their goals, but at this point in the season, you can't really just be using those two as an excuse anymore. And it's like what I said before, it just seemed like they didn't really have any real patterns of play. They do for about 10 minutes or maybe 20 minutes in this case, where they press quite well. And then it all just kind of stops. And you just think, well, if you can do that well for 20 minutes, but you know you can't do that for the rest of the game, then you have to have a backup plan of what's coming next. Or you have to know, you know, maybe for you do that right at the beginning of the second half and you make some changes. Like, you have to play to that if you know that you can't continue that for the rest of the game. And I feel like JC's a kind of perfect example of all this sort of mismatched talent. She's so... I thought she was actually really good at large spells of the game, but she gets the ball and does some incredible stuff, obviously has got incredible footwork, and then doesn't know what to do with it. And while if someone doesn't have that like cutting edge just yet, you need to help her and you need to have a structure around her that allows her to flourish in that way. At least have someone, you know, maybe it's Mallard in the box that you know that, okay, your instructions are, once you do all your trickery and everything that you're good at, your direct instructions are to cross it into the box or to do this. And I don't think she has that structure around her. And it's just all kind of looking quite mismatched. And I do feel for United fans, because even just quite obvious things like, you know, lads playing in centre mid, which they haven't had. And that midfield hasn't really worked for a while. And yeah, just a lot of kind of glaringly obvious problems that just don't seem to be fixed yet. And I don't think that can all be blamed on just Russo and Bache not being there anymore.
Yeah, also can't be blamed on VAR necessarily, but refereeing errors were a theme of the weekend, weren't we? We're going to see that throughout the episode, but starting in Manchester on Saturday, controversy reigning over Park's opener. Replay showed that Bunny Shaw had clearly strayed offside in the build-up. It was a goal that brought to a halt United's good start, which is why manager Mark Skinner then called for VAR after the game. This is what he had to say. In a derby, it swings the whole game. Is he right, Susie? Is it the reason for his team's defeats, or is that too simplistic?
I mean, it's a really great excuse for him, isn't it? Like, let's be real. I mean, I think Marva put it brilliantly a moment ago. We've seen this happen with United all too often, that they have a really, really bright, strong spell, press really well, and then sort of fade away. And that's the pattern that happened in this game. I mean, yes, you know, it's not ideal when you get a decision that is impactful, particularly around the first goal. And could it have changed things? Maybe. Like, but yeah, I think, you know, the fact that City got three, United score one, it's, I mean, that says it all, really, doesn't it? Like, you know, we saw how brilliant City were once they sort of built into the game and had sort of just waited out that Manchester United spell. So yeah, I mean, it's a good excuse, but you know, I think it's a little bit of deflection for some of the bigger issues that they've got going on there. But yeah, not great to see decisions like that, really not, across the weekend. It's a problem.
Yeah, it wasn't the first one. It continued, unfortunately, and down in East London, where it was Chelsea's turn to play catch-up. It finished West Ham 0, Chelsea 2. The win was bookended by goals for Emma Hayes' side. It was a result that kind of took them back to the... It did take them back to the table. Top on goal difference, in fact. Rianne Skinner was left fuming, though, at the performance of the officials. West Ham denied an equaliser when Hanaka Hayashi's effort was wrongly ruled out for offside. This is what she had to say. It's not good enough. The bottom line is, if that's how I operated in my job, I wouldn't be in it. People will say it's because we lost 2-0. It's because it's a frequent occurrence. It's near enough every week. Apologies after the game don't change the outcome. A lot of people talk about VAR and things like that. If this is where we are and that's the argument, we need to start going down in order to get results right. That's what we need to start doing. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Ultimately, the referees still aren't professional in this game, so they're not actually in a situation where they're solely focusing on these matches. I think that's got to change. The game has still got so much growing up to do. What do you make of her comments there, Sophie?
I would first say that I'm really pleased that she was really kind of honest in that interview. You know, we have so many interviews where managers don't really say what they think, and she will probably get punished for that. I guess there will be a fine coming. That's the, generally the case, isn't it, when you criticise the referees. But I think she's got a real point. You know, she brought up the three games this season where there have been goals that have stood against them. And then she just gets an apology after the game. And as she says there, it doesn't matter. Apologies don't change outcomes, do they? You can say sorry all you like and you can really mean it, but it doesn't mean the points go back on the board or, you know, West Ham are sitting 11th in the table at the moment. They don't climb up the table because of an apology. We'll go on to it, but I think they had their chances. So it probably didn't necessarily change the entire outcome of the game. But when you look at West Ham's first half and how much energy and effort they put into and how much they got their game plan right against a really strong Chelsea team. And I think Rhian Skinner was just really hurt by the fact that they weren't rewarded for that in that first half. It doesn't mean the outcome changes necessarily in the game, but you've got to be getting those decisions right. And I do agree with her about VAR. You know, VAR brings its own problems. I do think we're a bit away from that, in terms of especially the investment, and we need to get referees full time. They're professional, but they're not full time, and they need to be given all of the resources that they can. And I'll say it again and again, to be able to do their job to the best of their ability. And at the moment, when they're not full time referees, they can't. They just can't do that because they're doing other things during the week or whatever. So I think she has a real good point there.
Yeah, I mean, even the ones that are full-time are, which is about 50% of WSL referees, so we're not talking about lines people here at all, you know, although they sort of jump between the roles a little bit, is that, yeah, 50% are full-time professionals, but they are, like, that is, they're not like on a full-time contract, it's that they've been found enough bits of work to make up enough to have them working solely on refereeing. So it's not even as simple as, you know, they're on one contract that sees them through. They're on a few different bits that piece together the equivalent of a full-time salary for what they do, which is it's not really good enough, and they sort of need the professional standards of refereeing to be raised alongside the demands we're expecting of players and the game, which is getting, you know, significantly more investment than refereeing is, which is a real shame. But there's a lot of really good work being done refereeing wise. I went up to the PGMOL last camp and was really impressed with sort of the stuff that's being done. But decisions, like, I was watching this game, decisions were really, really poor. I mean, that really impacted that game. I mean, you know, we said that the decisions in the Man United game, you know, probably didn't swing things too significantly. But here, I think they potentially did. You know, this was really critical moments of the game. And, you know, it was two bad offside calls. And West Ham were playing really, really well. And I just think that it's a problem. Ironic, though, that it's West Ham that are speaking out and then adding in the call for VAR when they're the ones who don't play in their main stadium, which would help the argument for having VAR, because they're, you know, they have the capacity to do it at the big stadiums, but not at the small ones. And they're one of the only teams not to play at their main stadium at all.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It's there's kind of stages that need to happen, like has happened in the men's game, in terms of goal line technology perhaps coming in first, and then, you know, if you can get the offside technology in there, you wouldn't necessarily need the full VAR setup in terms of so many people at Stockley Park, etc., etc. But it's really difficult, and I know the hard work that's going on behind the scenes at PGMOL and the work that Bibby Steinhaus-Webb is doing, who's head of officials in the women's game. But unfortunately, if you don't give people full pay and time and effort, I think it's something that NewCo in particular have to really focus on when they take over. I think it has to be a priority. Talking about the rest of the game, Marva, West Ham did have the best of the first half. Obviously, they conceded early, but they were wasteful in front of goal as well. Vivian Asai missing a hat-trick of chances. Kirsty Smith turning a shot wide from an unmarked position. And Rico Wecky, who was brilliant, hit the crossbar as well, which was probably, you know, adding to Rhian Skinner's frustrations, really.
Yeah, I mean, it was a kind of crazy first half in that it could have been sort of 4-2 to West Ham by halftime. And as early as the Chelsea goal was, West Ham could have scored even before that in the first sort of 20 seconds. It was a really impressive performance from them. And it just kind of seemed like they sort of just ran out of energy and ran out of legs by the second half, which is understandable. But I think Asahi and Ueki particularly have been really, really strong for them all season, especially when, you know, they've struggled at the back, particularly at the beginning of the season. And to have that type of talent and technical ability that can then just go off and get you some goals is so, so important. Obviously, yesterday they weren't too, not even yesterday, Sunday. Obviously, Sunday they weren't too clinical, but I think it's a good sign of progress they have made throughout the season. It was looking really worrying for them for a bit, whereas I do think they'll be okay. And not only just be okay, but I think they're actually building something that they can build off on even more. They've got quite a good spine now, I think. And yeah, some really exciting talent as well.
Sophie, that was Chelsea's sixth game in March. Just as a bit of a comparison, West Ham have played three. Obviously, Chelsea in Champions League action, but they looked really tired, didn't they? And it wasn't their best performance. But as Susie said earlier on, when we were talking about Manchester City, it's kind of what Chelsea do best at this time of year, isn't it?
This is the time that they thrive, as Susie kind of said earlier. Yes, they're playing a lot of football. And I think that's what makes people maybe stand up and think Manchester City have the easier running. But actually, I think Chelsea really love this time of year. Yes, they look tired at times. Yes, they're playing every 3 or 4 days, but they are in a momentum flow and they keep getting results. And the more that they win, the more that confidence builds into the next game. So you're less tired in 3 days' time after you've just won. So it's what they do. I think they also have the squad to be able to bring in fresh legs. I think that's what turned it in that second half. You know, bringing on Kat Macario and Mayra Ramirez in that second half, that was just like the last thing West Ham wanted to see when they were tired, because they're two world-class quality players who can come on and change games and bring fresh energy. And both of them haven't played that much football in recent weeks. So they are coming back fresh from injury, which is good for them. And it gives Chelsea different options to play with. And we know that Emma Hayes is a bit of a chameleon when it comes to her tactics. She can change things up very, very quickly. And you saw that in the last few games. So she's got options, and I just wouldn't bet against them at this time of year in anything, personally.
Yeah, Aggie Beaver-Jones said it as well afterwards, that, you know, it wasn't their best performance, that we weren't up to scratch today, we weren't up to standard, but we have games every 3 days, so we're happy with it and we got the job done. We're champions of England, we want to be in awful competitions, it creates opportunities for us to get fresh legs off the bench. I think that, like, sums it up, right? Like, they're just brutally efficient at this point and they know what they've got to do to get it done. And I thought it was like a really mature performance from her, who's, you know, dipping in and out of the team and grabbing those opportunities when she gets them because of all these games. And like a really, really good interview with her post-match where she sort of, you know, kind of basically told it how it was really, really accurately.
Ultimately, you don't remember the performances, do you? You remember the results at the end of the day, and it actually doesn't matter how they get it over the line. If they're scrappy in a few games, who cares? If they're winning trophies, that's what matters.
Yes, we'll see come the end of the season. There was another hiccup for Arsenal, though. They've not had the greatest of preparations the last 2 weeks for their matches, have they? This time, caught in traffic on the way to Birmingham, delaying the evening kickoff by 45 minutes. To be fair to them, although Sockgate was obviously amusing at times, but probably stressful for them, I'm not sure that they can actually be blamed for the unpredictability of the M1, but it was another disruption for them that they had to deal with, which will have been frustrating. But they handled things a lot better than they did last week against Chelsea, overcoming a slow start to eventually win 3-1. It was a result that put them 8 points clear of fourth-placed Liverpool, some much-needed breathing space in the race for Champions League qualification. So Aston Villa 1, Arsenal 3 was the final result. And academy product Ebony Salmon delighted the home fans when she opened the scoring, but goals from Victoria Pelova, Lotta Vuben-Moy and Stina Blackstenius managed to turn the game around for Jonas Eidevall's side. The first half kind of seemed like the same old problem actually for them. They've struggled really with low defensive blocks all season, and the hosts were happy to absorb that pressure, picking their moment to attack. The second half though, Sophie, was a bit of a different story with Arsenal dominating. What kind of changed for them after halftime?
I think they were able to solve problems a lot better in this game. And they were facing a Villa side who were set up really compact. They were in a 5-3-2 formation, making it really, really hard for Arsenal to get through. And they were just waiting for that moment to pick Arsenal off in that first half. And Arsenal were just not intense enough. I think they gave themselves a big talking to at the break and they shifted a few things around. They became so much more intense in the press. So they were really pressuring the Villa back line whenever they had the ball, which wasn't happening in the first half. And it created turnovers and possession and mistakes from that defensive area. And then they were also trying to pull Villa's midfield around a bit because I think it was too static in the first half and they were just allowed to stay in that solid line, whereas actually in the second half they started attacking from different focal points, which meant that Villa got a bit more confused and a bit more frayed in their structure. So I think there was a few tactical things that they solved. I think it was actually really interesting because it was kind of the first time really I've seen that Arsenal have fixed that kind of problem. Yes, there was the Leicester game early in the season, but it wasn't quite the same playing against a low block team. Leicester weren't low block that day, but they have failed to problem solve in games recently against those kind of sides who want to just sit low and defend. So it was quite, I think, maybe a turning point for them in terms of finding those solutions to those problems and finding that intensity that they needed to find the goal. And you felt in the second half it could have been, you know, six goals, but for Anna Leeting in goal and the woodwork a couple of times, it could have been a much heavier scoreline. So yeah, they found the solutions this time.
Yeah, it was another disappointing result for Carla Ward, wasn't it? Still aiming for a top six finish, Susie. Her side's been decimated by illness and injury in recent weeks. She actually said pre-match she only had 12 players in training. I mean, that's just so difficult to prepare for a game. We've had this email from Luke. He said, is it time for Aston Villa to part ways with Carla Ward and start fresh next season with a brand new coach? He brings up losing several high-profile players and a lack of game plays. But what do you think, Susie?
I mean, I wouldn't write Carla Ward off. Whether she wants to stay at Aston Villa or not is another thing. Like, who knows? But, you know, I think she's an extremely talented manager and I think a lot of clubs will notice that she's, you know, not necessarily having the best time of it at Aston Villa at the moment, just, you know, in terms of results and personnel around her and things like that, in terms of like, yeah, holding on to their players and stuff, whether they can keep some of the big players that they signed last summer happy when they're, you know, kind of down in the middle of the table to the bottom half of the table is a big, big question. So I don't think you should ever write a manager off in this league after a season. I mean, obviously there's exceptions to the rule, but I think that we're getting a little bit too short-termism. You know, all of these teams are relatively new to high-level professional football and that takes time. And you're not going to just break into the top three after one good season. It's just not going to happen. And I think until we're a little bit more realistic about that and stick with managers through, you know, quite difficult dips in form while they're building and you can see some kind of like identity and project there, then, you know, I wouldn't be getting rid of managers over blips. You know, there's just so many examples of where that doesn't end well.
I would also just say, I think she got her game plan spot on in that first half, particularly. She knew exactly what Arsenal's weaknesses were this season. Aston Villa knew what their weaknesses were this season. They knew how they had to set up to play against them. The problem for Villa is that they didn't have options off the bench to change things when they needed to. And because their squad is so slim at the moment with kind of the sale of Blinkilda Brown to Manchester City in January window, plus the injuries to like Staniforth and Lucy Parker, it just means the options are really low. Like Jordan Nobbs was playing as a defensive midfielder. You know, that's where they've got to with this because of those options. And the only striker she could bring on was Georgia Mullet. Yes, Alicia Lehmann was on the bench, but Georgia Mullet is a young girl coming through the academy system and getting her first like sprinklings of senior football. So it just means that those options are low. So when you're trying to change things up and things start not going your way, it just makes it a lot harder. But I do think that game plan in the first half was absolutely perfect. It's what they needed to do against Arsenal.
The stats though are hilarious, right? Like it's 66% possession to Arsenal and then 37 shots to one, 13 shots on targets to one, 11 corners to none and 7 fouls to one. Like it is just, it's really funny, you know, when you get the chart where they're like all the bars are across like in colour showing how much a team has dominated and there's basically no Aston Villa on there. It's really good.
Well, not for Carla Ward, it's not. She's probably looking at that. And
from a just like, amusing point of view.
Yes, from an Arsenal fan point of view, I'm more thinking. Listen, couple of things to focus on. We have to talk about Arsenal's last goal, don't we, Marva? It was a bit of a comedy of errors. Ended up with the ball in the back of the net. I'll give you a bit of a picture of it if I can describe it properly. Stina Blackstenius played through. The assistant missed that she was offside. She broke into the box, and as she cut inside to shoot, she then slipped. She fell on the ball, handling the ball in the process, got back up to her feet, then nutmegged three Aston Villa players to send the ball into the back of the net. I mean, I don't understand how the officials missed that, Marva. The mistakes happen, but this was quite a big one.
Yeah, that is like unforgivable in that sense. If she's, I mean, an offside, you know, we see that all the time across every league in the world. But when someone falls on the ball, I don't know how that cannot be a handball. It's like, it's more likely that it's a handball than not. So how you miss that, I don't know. But I do just love that if anyone was new to the WSL and wanted a 5-second summary of what Stina Blackstenius' season has been like or what she's like as a player, I think just show those 5 seconds because that perfectly encapsulates her as a player in terms of just running in behind, which is what she's great at, doesn't always get it right in terms of timing, then slips over, but then somehow not makes three players. I think it's just the perfect summary of her. I did just want to touch as well on that back line of Arsenal because I think, obviously, you know, Lea Williamson coming back in wasn't the best game for her against Chelsea, but Fox, I think, has been so, so good since she's joined. And I was looking at that back four, and once that gets a bit more settled, especially with Moyes had such a good season, that back four of Fox, Williamson, Wibamoy and McCabe, that's such a ridiculous back four in terms of ball-playing ability and attacking ability. Like, you could move those four up into the midfield, and that would be a great midfield. So to have that as your four starting defenders as well, it's just really, really impressive. And I think if that starts to, you know, Leah coming back and she gets into it a little bit more and they settle down, I think that's a really, really dangerous back four. And maybe starting to see some problems being solved, but I wouldn't go too far too quickly with Arsenal because we know what they can be like.
Well, impressive back four, but just a really quick one for you, Susie. And it's really difficult highlighting a player like this, but Ryan has sent us a message on social media saying, could it cost Jonas Eidevall in the long run if he keeps persisting with Manuela Zinsberger as his number one? I'm not saying she should be permanently dropped, but at least taken out of the firing line for a few games. I mean, obviously, she wasn't tested this weekend, so but we know that she's not been at her best this season. D'Angelo has proven she's more than capable. And we also signed 8-time Champions League winner Sarah Bouadi in January, and she's not had a look in yet.
Yeah, and she's on her way out. She put a sort of goodbye message on social media yesterday or day before, I think. You know, Sarah Bouadi is, you know, was a great keeper, but I think she's firmly at the end of her career. And that was a little bit of a desperate signing when they were really struggling with D'Angelo away at the Gold Cup. So, you know, I don't think she is, you know, definitely, well, she's definitely not the solution because she's not going to be there. But it's a hard one, isn't it, right? Like, you want to show faith in your number one, and you withdraw a goalkeeper and the risk is that you shatter their confidence, right? Like, that's the difficulty. Balancing two goalkeepers and rotating them in and out is, it does it work? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Like, we've seen the sort of to in and throwing on it on the Arsenal men's side as well. Like, there's not a, you know, well, there's a clearer number one there and the quality of the goalkeepers is much, much higher. But do Arsenal need a new goalkeeper, a really, really top world-class one? Arguably, yes. Should they be ditching Zinsberger before the end of the season? I'm not totally convinced. I'm not... D'Angelo's good, but I'm not sure she's the, like, long-term answer. So then what are you thinking? It's a tough one. It's a tough one because, yeah, goalkeepers thrive on playing regularly as well and confidence. And you drop one so close to the end of the season and you risk shattering any confidence that she does have. It's not, yeah, not an easy question. Not an easy answer.
No. It's not, but it's a great question, Ryan. Thank you for that. Right, that's it for part one. In part two, we'll round up the rest of the weekend's WSL results and we'll take a look at the latest FA Women's National League and Championship action. welcome back to part two of the Guardian Women's Football Weekly. Let's take you through the rest of the weekend's WSL results. Fans at King Power Stadium were treated to a five-goal thriller on Sunday afternoon. It finished Leicester City 2, Brighton 3, with Brighton coming from behind to leapfrog Leicester in the table. It was a competitive but goalless first half, but the game burst into life in the second when Jutta Rantala scored her sixth goal of the season to give the Foxes the lead. Madison Haley equalised for the Seagulls in fortunate circumstances before Katie Robinson broke through to put them ahead. Lena Peterman then equalised for the hosts, but Elizabeth Turlin struck just a minute later to make sure Mikey Harris's team took home all 3 points. And Sophie, Brighton have had a couple of heavy results recently, but they will have been buoyed by the way they fought back in this one. How important will this win be for them in the home run?
Yeah, I think it's super important. And I think the positives from it is they look creative on Sunday, which I don't think they've looked particularly creative in the last couple of games. So I think that will give them a lot of confidence going forward. I think the fact that they're scoring goals is big as well. They really capitalised on Leicester's some like kind of creaky defence, especially in transition. Katie Robinson's goal and Turlin's goal were both scored on that kind of counter-attack. And they just basically blitzed through the Leicester midfield and defence. And I think they will get the confidence from that. I'm still not sure what the entire plan is with Brighton, to be honest. Some people have said they've really improved. I haven't seen the stark improvements since, you know, the rest of the season. The results are still a bit dodgy apart from this one, but they are pretty safe, aren't they? So I think it's about getting to the end of the season, working out a plan for a new coach coming in, because Mikey Harris is interim. I don't think he will be made permanent, or I'm pretty sure he won't be. So I think they will be looking for a long-term solution in the summer, and it's just about getting to that point with this squad right now.
Yeah, back-to-back defeats now for Leicester as well under Jem Foster. They face a tough trip to Aston Villa ahead of their FA Cup semi-final as well. Should they be worried about their form in these last two games, Susie?
I mean, yes. They've got a really, really tough run. That's what I'm most worried about. Are they safe? Potentially, you know, there's a 10-point gap between them and Bristol City at the bottom, but they've got a really, really, really difficult run. I mean, obviously got Villa next, but then they've got Spurs, Arsenal, Man United before West Ham and Liverpool. Like, they're really tricky games. They're not going to get many points from that, so they're going to have to really, really hope that the others around them don't do too well either. But like, you would hope that they've done enough across the course of the season to have just about protected them against this tricky run in. But yeah, I mean, it's a tough way to lose.
Yep, certainly is. Nobody lost over on Merseyside, though. Everton hosted Liverpool at Goodison Park, and it finished Everton 0, Liverpool 0. It kind of promised a lot, this game, didn't it? But just offered very little in terms of excitement, ultimately. Bit of a story of two halves. Liverpool edging the first, Everton the better in the second. Marva, your side did create chances after the break, competed hard, but kind of lacked that clinical edge again, which seems to be the story of your season, doesn't it? But, that, you know, the good news is you welcome back Katrina Veya and Karen Holmgaard from long-term injury. But what did you make of the performance overall?
Yeah, it wasn't a classic. Definitely wasn't a Merseyside derby classic. There was a point where I just wanted Pierre Monte on, not even because we particularly needed her, but I just wanted a bit of like fight and aggression and just someone to cause some like bit of, you know, push and shoving. Yeah, wasn't the best, but I think for Everton's point of view, we needed to not lose that more than anything. So I think we did that, which is good. You know, we've been a bit disappointing, particularly in the beginning of the season in terms of leaking goals. And I think in the last few games, we've seemed to have done a little bit better than that, other than the Villa game. But even that, I still don't think we were particularly that bad. But like you said, it's our clinical edge, which has just been the problem all season. You could probably clip up everything I've said on the pod for this whole season and just repeat it, because it's literally the same. All I would say is that this game, we didn't particularly create that many chances. Whereas other games, we've like, I've had my head in my hands, like, how have we not scored that? Whereas this game was more just a you know, the closest we got was that Lucy Hope strike, which is just a great strike, but it wasn't one that you're like, how did she not score that? If it goes in, you go, oh my God, how did she score that? So I don't know if that's an improvement. I don't think that maybe is worse. I don't know. But yeah, it was just a bit nothing in terms of the whole game. But I think we'll be the happier team with that. And I did quite like how Matt Beard seems to have taken a leaf out of the Jurgen Klopp playbook, which is after a Goodison disappointing draw. He blamed it on the long grass, which Jurgen Klopp has once blamed it on the wind. So I think they're learning something there over on the other side of Merseyside, but we'll take that.
Yeah, the game itself was a bit meh, wasn't it? But the comments, this is exactly what he said, Matt Beard, because I mean, he was pretty frustrated, wasn't he, on the sideline. They've been so good this season, but this game was a little bit lackluster. So this is what he said about the Goodison pitch. The pitch was dry, the grass was long, it slowed a lot down. And then he said, it didn't feel like a derby. What did you make of his comments, Sophie?
Classic deflection, I think. I mean, has he seen Prenton Park and that pitch? I know, like they went to Goodison Park, so you expect more of I guess, Premier League standard pitch, but it's not kind of the excuse. I didn't actually notice it being that slow, to be honest. The game was really stopped to start anyway. There was a lot of like injury niggles and people going down all the time. So it just had no rhythm to it, I think, the whole game. And I think Matt Beard, he was just getting increasingly frustrated. You could see him on the touchline. Every time there was a foul, he'd turn around to the fourth official and have a little word. And he was just like throwing his arms up in the air. And at one point he was about to shout, and then he decided better of it. So he went to take a water out of the cooler just to calm himself down. I think, yeah, he was just frustrated by the fact that it was a real chance, I think, for Liverpool to open up a bit more of a gap over Manchester United and to make that fourth place their own, and they didn't take it. And he will have felt that given on their seasons that they should have beaten Everton. I will say though, I'm so happy, like I'm so pleased for Everton at the moment, because yes, it's not going all their way, but the way that they're competing in every single game, I just think it's kudos to the way that the players are going about their football, because it's been hard. They've had basically no players at some points in the season. You know, you've got Aurora Galli still playing at right back. She's not a right back. She's a midfielder. So I think they have to be given credit for the amount of effort they do put into every game, even if it's not coming off every time.
With that as well, I love that we had Ben Havenmott playing as that Millie Bright centre forward at the end. So she's played centre mid, centre back, and centre forward in like the last few games. It's just like they can do with what we have.
I did love the last 5 minutes where he just was like, I think Everton were just like, they were so structured all the way through the game. The last 5 minutes, they were like, we're just going to go for this. And I was like, what are you doing? They sent Van Havenmont up front. All of the structure just disappeared before your eyes. And Liverpool just were able to burst through them for the first time in the game. So, yeah, it was quite funny.
Brilliant. I tell you what, though, Matt Beard shouldn't be too disappointed, because that result actually saw them leap above Manchester United into fourth. But as you say, they'd quite like to cement that fourth spot, I would expect. Final game to talk through in the WSL finished Bristol City 0, Tottenham Hotspur 1, a narrow victory for Spurs. Bethany England, though, has been really hampered by injury, had to undergo hip surgery at the start of the campaign, which saw her miss a large part of this season, was on the score sheet after just 2 minutes. And there was understandable delight for that, Susie. First league goal of the season, a cool finish off a trademark team move. And actually, the 70th WSL goal for the Tottenham captain, making her only the second player to have reached that tally behind Vivian Miedemar. I mean, she's had such an impact on the league and on this Tottenham side, despite this season barely playing.
Yeah, like it's been a tough season for her, and I imagine tough to watch from the bench when Spurs have struggled a little bit here and there. And like arguably when she's come on, she's not looked her best. But great to see her come on, great to see her like start, get a goal and be the game changer again, because I think that was what was missing from her. That said, like I've been really impressed with Spurs this season, and they should have got more from this game. You know, they should have put it to bed very, very early on for me. But yeah, I mean, they won't be sad about 3 points, will they? They're doing really well.
Yep, they are doing really well. But things look a little bit bleak for Bristol City. 6 points adrift at the bottom of the table now, Marva. Lauren Smith once again praising her side's resilience, but she said she was gutted they conceded so early. But I tell you the biggest problem for them, there's a bit of a lack of creativity, it feels, from a team who've actually, in this game, only produced one shot on target, which is just not good enough, really.
No, but you can kind of see what they're trying to do, and they have sort of managed to pull it off in the few times they have, in the sense of, you know, they are a very low block team. Then they kind of counter with very direct football, which is enjoyable to watch, you know, when they do pull it off, and they're kind of working with what they have. I don't think they really have that talent to be able to, you know, play possession football, and especially against the sides that we have in the WSL. So you can see the thinking behind it of, let's be a bit pragmatic with it. But I think when you're playing like that, then you do need that clinical edge, and it's a risky game, because especially if you concede early like that, and then you're forced to push up and try something else. And when you're not used to that, this game could have been about 4-0 by the end of it. But I have been impressed with Bristol and how they have managed to sort of stick to that game plan and sometimes pull it off. And I think, you know, we've seen before, you know, teams who have been promoted get absolutely battered constantly, and they're not a team that have done that. But like you said, it's just the other end of the pitch that's cost them, really.
Yeah, certainly has. Right. The Barclays Women's Championship. OMG, this league every single week, entering its final furlong, continue to throw up the drama again on Sunday. Here's what happened. Sunderland continued their superb form, staying top. They held off successive Durham comebacks to win 5-3 in an absolutely thrilling derby. Crystal Palace kept pace with a comfortable win over Watford in front of a record crowd at Selhurst Park, while Birmingham capped off a strong week with a 2-0 victory over Lewis to move into third place. Not such good news for Charlton, though. They dropped down after conceding two late goals against Remy Allen's London City Lionesses, while Southampton also slipped up with defeat to Blackburn. Sheffield United, meanwhile, cruised past Reading, leaving the Royals firmly in the fight for survival, along with Lewis and Watford. It's just the gift that keeps on giving, this league, Sophie, isn't it?
It is. I was actually rather disappointed that there was only like one real upset this week, because every weekend you're expecting all of the results to go a little bit crazy. But it's going to be an exciting final four games, I think, of the season. I think that's what's left. So like 4-3 cup finals left for each team. Everything to play for. There's something like 6 points separating the top five or something. So it's absolutely tight as anything. Anything can happen in these last few games. I think we'll see lots of changes in those last three games as well, because nothing is ever predictable, and it will go down to the final game of the season.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Well, I don't love it that much going down to the final game of the season. It gives me palpitations as a Luton Town fan. Actually, and that's where we're going to next, Kenilworth Road, because hashtag United lifted the first piece of silverware of the FA Women's National League season, beating Newcastle United 2-1 in the League Cup at the mighty Kenilworth Road. And hashtag United have a bit of a unique story, Susie, don't they? And they were definitely the underdogs going into Sunday's final. How big a victory was this for them?
Oh, huge. I mean, yeah, really, like, relatively new team. You know, it's only a few years old that hashtag United formed a women's team and invested, like, fairly well, but, like, nothing in comparison to the investment that is happening at Newcastle at the moment, which, you know, I have my own opinions on. But, you know, they've got full-time players really pushing for, you know, rapid rise up the leagues via promotion. So, yeah, really, like, exciting for the neutral to see the journey not go completely smooth sailing, I think, as well. You know, like, it takes time to establish a team that can challenge and compete in multiple competitions. And, you know, yes, you can go professional, but that doesn't necessarily make a team in and of itself. There's going to be slip-ups along the way. And, yeah, I think it's good for the game that it was hashtag United getting the win, and probably actually good for Newcastle in the long run to have, you know, they've had it pretty smooth sailing so far, but, you know, a little blip on the road will help make them stronger too.
Yeah, well, you've part answered Nag's question, actually, there, Susie. Sophie, to follow up on it, they want to know how important it is for the game as a whole, but also, will we see more clubs in Tier 3 following Newcastle and going professional?
It's important, because you don't want to see one team dominate. So I think it's important that you can have parity in the league, even when there is a financial resource and resources gap between two teams, and that they can still compete on that stage on their day. I would hope so with Tier 3, but the problem with Tier 3 is it is, you know, it's kind of an amateur semi-pro league at the moment. And until there is more pathway up into the championship and like a real like fluid movement process between the two, it's going to be a few years yet until we see more clubs invest that fully in it, just because if you can't get out of that league, what is the incentive necessarily in terms of putting a ton of money behind them? So Newcastle did it with a really specific aim to get up to the Championship, and then I presume the WSL is what they're hoping for eventually in Champions League football. And I think other clubs might try it, but I think it's really hard when the options of moving up are so slim at the moment.
Yeah, listen, it was a brilliant weekend in general across the FA Women's National League. 35,000 in attendance across the leagues, over 10,000 turning up to watch Ipswich Town beat Chatham Town at Portman Road as well. And in the actual football in the table itself, things are really hotting up. We're at the business end, obviously. Newcastle and Portsmouth comfortably leading the way in the Northern and Southern Premier Divisions respectively, both favourites for promotion. It is the first year that both league winners will secure a move into the Championship, which makes perfect sense, and I don't know why it didn't happen before. But how important is that pathway for the future of the pyramid, Marva?
Yeah, really important. It's just so important to grow all levels. I think there's such a big gap at the moment. And I say, even with sort of friends playing sort of tier six, tier seven, tier five, you kind of have this problem of people who have all this talent and they're choosing not to play the higher levels because there's no incentive, as Sophie was saying, which means that a lot of the talent is just getting lost because there's no reason for them to. Why would you go and travel, you know, all the way up and down the country when you could just travel up and down London just for the sake of it? So with no actual real incentive. So the more we grow those levels, we're going to see that, hopefully, you know, not see what we do in the men's game of kind of it all just focused in one area. And hopefully we see that across the board, and just more opportunities for women to play football in a way that actually benefits them and isn't just sort of taking out of their pockets and having to travel all up and down the country for nothing.
Yeah, hear, hear. Just to wrap up here, unfortunately, London Bees and Chatham Town both had relegation to Tier 4 confirmed, and that's actually going to get really tight coming into the last couple of months. But there was sad news as Selsey's relegation was confirmed this weekend. Graham on X has asked if we can give the club an honourable mention. Here's what he had to say. They've had a torrid time every game, but they turn up and play their hearts out and deserve huge props for sticking with it. So big up to Selsey. Finally, the quarterfinals of the UEFA Women's Champions League conclude this week. Chelsea bring a 3-0 lead over Ajax back to Stamford Bridge, but things are finally poised elsewhere. Barcelona host Bran, Lyon entertain Benfica, and Hacken travel to PSG. Any surprises we can expect, Sophie? We kind of wrote them off last week, didn't we?
Logic would say that the favourites will go through, especially since they're all playing at home. But I do think the performances from that first leg were really impressive from the likes of, I mean, all of those games other than the Chelsea's one ended 2-1 to the favourites. So they every team put up a big fight. Bran, I was so, like, that was absolutely magical, the Bran game against Barcelona, and the reaction of Cavani when she scores. She looks like she just doesn't know what's happened to her. She's just scored against Barcelona and she's just like, I don't know what on earth is going on with me. But I think it's I'm just really happy that they competed really hard in those games, and it's not as clear-cut as we probably expected it to be from that first leg. And, you know, it's football. Anything can happen on a day. You know, one of these teams could have a really bad day, and, you know, a Bran or a Hacking could have a really good day and take advantage of that. So I think it's exciting that it's all to play for in this second leg.
Yep, it is. And we'll bring you all the reaction from the results next week, of course, as well. Right, we got through it. Susie Rack, how are you feeling? Are you going back to bed?
I wish. I've got another podcast to do and like a meeting and then a personal training session. I'm going to die. Goodbye.
Yes, I mean, listen, the fact that you arranged a personal training session a day after winning gold at the SJAs is quite incredible, and also absolutely bonkers.
Idiotic.
Yes, yeah, totally. Sophie, pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me.
Marva, see you soon.
See you soon. Thank you.
Thank you all as ever as well. Keep having your say by sending in your questions via X or emailing us at womensfootballweekly@theguardian.com. So we'll bring you all the news from the Champions League next week as well. Serena Wiegmann names her England's squad as well for the upcoming internationals. We'll go through all of her decisions next week as well. As ever, your weekly reminder to sign up for our bi-weekly women's football newsletter. All you need to do is search Moving the Goalposts, sign up. This is what we have in store for you this week in Tuesday's edition. Alex Ibaceta sits down with Barcelona's Caroline Graham Hansen. And on Thursday, Eduardo Tansley looks at the women's game in the Dominican Republic. The Guardian Women's Football Weekly is produced by Sophie Downey and Silas Gray. Music composition was by Laura Iredale. Our executive producer is Sal Ahmad. Women's Football Weekly is supported by Google Pixel, the only phone engineered by Google and official mobile phone of Arsenal Football Club, Liverpool Football Club and the England teams. Engineered by Google, the Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro are fast and secure with the most advanced Pixel cameras yet. And Google AI powers amazing features for photos and video so you can get even closer to the game. Search Google Store to find out more.
This is The Guardian.